talk from someone who really can bring more perspectives than pretty much anyone else to the world of research. Tom Lundell has been head of department in the biochemistry department here at Cambridge, defended and pushed science to government over many years, as well as being one of the preeminent structural biologists in the UK, and also treading the path between academic research and industrial research on a number of occasions. So to kick off the morning, we've already got the slide.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here and to celebrate Peter's mid-career symposium. I was delighted when I was invited to give a talk. When I was invited, I thought, well, this is really about Peter's career. And then I thought, well, I begin and say a little bit. Maybe it was because I've known Peter for 45 years, I think, since he first came into the laboratory where I was in Oxford and where he'd been before. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. But I've followed Peter's career from behind, always from behind. So I may not be the most knowledgeable about the motivation. I started off in Oxford, not by meeting Peter, but by hearing about this guy who was just incredibly intelligent. And I got the top first in chemistry, and all the rest of us who'd come in to do our PhDs in chemical crystallography were certainly going to have a major problem in keeping up. The next thing where I found I was behind Peter was that I'd been interested in African politics, and indeed I'd been to Thomas Hodgkin's African lectures when he visited occasionally Oxford, and I found that Peter had got there before. The reason why he wasn't in chemical crystallography at that time in Oxford was he was in the University of Ghana, influenced by Dorothy Hodgkin, but I guess ultimately by the fact that Thomas Hodgkin was out there in Africa. And then Peter came back just at the time when we were starting our PhDs proper. So he was really 2 years ahead of me. And it was just amazing. Peter, I remember, talked most of the time he was doing his PhD. I think he did just about everyone else's PhD for them. There were all ideas sparking, lots of excitement, and just fantastic to have him around. And then I can remember on one occasion we both decided we wanted to work with Dorothy Hodgkin and move from small molecules to large ones. I can remember going with Peter in to see Dorothy, I don't know whether Peter remembers this, and Dorothy looked at Peter and said, well, we know that you did very well. And of course, indicating that Peter got a first in chemistry and done lots of very exciting things. And Dorothy looked at me, and she wasn't very good at asking direct questions, but I realized she wanted to know whether I got a first, whether I could join the team. And so eventually it turned out that that I had, and I was just hoping that Dorothy didn't ask me whether I got the Gibbs Prize. Now, Peter took the difficult route. He was invited up to Stirling at that point, so he didn't join Dorothy Hodgkin. He went up to teach in a new university, I think a very courageous thing to do at that stage in his career. And I stayed on in Oxford. Later on, I interacted with Peter when he'd moved to Glaxo in Greenford, and I remember going to see what he was doing with all sorts of new ideas and new technologies, molecular graphics and intranets and lots of other things, and was really working on on drug molecules, whereas we were working on proteins that might be drugs or might be targets. And then he moved, and I'm never quite sure how he was funded at this time, but he was at Nottingham and Birkbeck at various times in the following years doing inspirational teaching. I know because I'd been at Birkbeck and went back to see all the multimedia courses and things that Peter had been involved in. And then finally, this is the only thing I got slightly ahead of him. I got to Cambridge a few years before he did and was absolutely delighted to find him join us. So that's what I thought I would say a little bit about and move it into the future. But then it was an invitation to visions of a molecular future. But then I looked at the next email and I realized that it was an invitation to the semantic molecular future. And as I thought about it, semantic got larger when I saw the program and more formidable. And I realized I wasn't asked to introduce this program because I'd known Peter for 45 years, but probably because I didn't know the meaning of semantics, or indeed I had no idea of the semantics of meaning. And this gave everyone else lots of opportunity to put things right later on. So, of course, I'm a just-in-time person, and so yesterday, desperately, I went to the web, where else, and I found a lecture by Peter, recorded in 2006. So I thought I'd better see where I was. So I found that the good was open source, CML, mashups, bioclips, and I got a little bit worried. I became even more worried as Peter's very articulate lecture proceeded, beautifully recorded, by the way. A few problems with the internet as he went along, one or two things missing, but, you know, if you do these hands-on things. But then he got to some of the bad and ugly, and I realized I was in real trouble for this lecture. God, first, I was using PowerPoint. Well, too late to change at the moment. I'll do a retrospective on this and see how I've done later on. PDF, well, that's easy to hate, but I rather liked Peter's description in his talk of being about trying to transfer things out of PDF as taking going from hamburgers to cows, very difficult task. And then I got more worried as he described the pharmaceutical industry incredibly critically, and had a little diagram that I failed to reproduce called the flow of wealth, which basically meant that the wealth flowed round to the advantage of the few and to the disadvantage of everyone else. And then finally, on the bad and the ugly list, was the American Chemical Society, limiting what you could do with the web and threatening to sue all sorts of people. And I realized as president of the Biochemical Society, and of course, we have the Portland Press, where we make $1 million a year out of the Biochemical Journal, that probably Peter had the same kind of criticism. So I thought that this lecture, what I probably ought to do is to do a retrospective, sort of looking forward at the same time, and ask whether there were any hopeful signs in what I've done over the years, and then come back at the end and assess against these criteria where there might be some hope. So what I decided I would do is I would talk about genomes a little bit, what we could do with information from those. I would talk about where I think the future lies at the moment, both for molecular structural biology and indeed for drug discovery, and that is the hugely complex molecules and assemblies below the cell level and above the individual molecular level. And then I'd say a little bit about things closer to where Peter's been as we move down initially at a reductionist level, but never for long, to enzyme inhibitor complexes and finally to candidate drugs. So the general theme will be structural molecular biology and visions for that. But I thought that I would talk about the travels during that time between industry and academia. So that's my task. So let me start at the beginning, and that is that when Peter left for Stirling, I stayed on to work with Dorothy Hodgkin, and you can see that I chose the easy option, because after 35 years of Dorothy working on insulin, in 2 years the structure came out, just when I was around, got two nice Nature papers out of that. And I just point out that picture of Dorothy on the bottom, a little bit older there, but that's a plastic model. And I had trouble getting that in to the customs also, I might say, Robbie, because when I brought that in to Canada in 1969 or 70, I was carrying it in a large case, and the guy said, "What's that?" I said, "It's a model of insulin." He said, "Well, what's that?" Well, I said, "It's something you give to people to make them well." He said, I said, "Well, it's a drug." "Oh," he said, and it took me away. So we all had troubles with models. But the insulin story got me thinking about information, because we were lucky. We worked on insulin because insulin was available. It was produced in large quantities by companies. It wasn't an academic choice. The reason why Fred Sanger worked on it was because it was available to sequence, and fairly, obviously a fairly small molecule compared with other proteins. And I'm sure Dorothy had worked on it because crystals were available from the pharmaceutical industry. And so in the following years, I began to think what we could do with the sequences. And this is a rather complicated figure, but insulin has two chains, the B chain and the A chain. And I started to write the sequence down where I could annotate the sequence with the structural information. And we formalized this a little bit later. But what we saw fairly soon was that this simple molecule had a number of cysteine residues which formed disulfides. They were obviously important. We could see there were a number of hydrophobic residues in the core, and then there were some funny things. There were things like glycines, and these were absolutely conserved. So I began to ask the question, and we were privileged because we had many more sequences than any other known three-dimensional structure, what it was about these conservation that would lead to the structure being conserved. And conversely, if we had a structure, if we projected from three dimensions onto a one-dimensional linear sequence, what would we get? And therefore, if we saw a conserved set of sequences, could we go from the linear sequence to say things about the three-dimensional structures? And that proved to be a very profitable area, because here are some insulin and pro-insulin models. And then as I read the literature on Saturday mornings, and it was only took a Saturday morning to find everything that had been published, and certainly it didn't come in electronic form, I found something which was called somatomedin. It's now called IGF, which looked a hell of a lot like insulin. And then another molecule which was a little bit more different, and then one which was hugely different, relaxin, which is involved in dilation of the pupus symphysis prior to parturition, so enables you to give birth. And I made all of these predictions to the growing antagonism of the experimental crystallographers. Crystallographers are hopelessly dependent on experiment, and on the whole, although they use computing a lot, and I say to myself, very, very skeptical about anybody who does any speculation. And so with all of this, I was beginning to get a very bad reputation for speculating. I published almost all of this, by the way, in Nature, and I can tell you that every single prediction was right. It's been confirmed subsequently, and I was pretty sure that was the case. There was one case where people following what we were thinking, in particular a good friend of mine, Ralph Bradshaw, predicted that nerve growth factor might belong to the same set. So I set it against the same criteria and found it didn't work. Indeed, it had the right number of disulfide bridges, but it certainly wasn't a member of the family and therefore couldn't belong to that three-dimensional structure. And I'm I must say that at that point, I not only made close friends with Ralph Bradshaw, and we worked together, but also I decided to do some experiments. And I just wanted to note that there is another Murray Rust around. I don't know whether she's here. Hi, good to see you. Because you see, Judith was absolutely key on working on this problem. And I'd like you just to note the date, 1991. When we started thinking about this, it was the early 70s, and it took a hell of a long time to solve it experimentally. But that meant, of course, that the information was limited, and we needed to be able to distinguish where the information was relevant to prediction. Now, amongst all this criticism, and I really did get a hell of a lot of criticism from structural biologists, and the Cambridge Laboratory of Molecular Biology, by the way, was the most unforgiving. And people like Max Prutz and indeed Dorothy thought you really ought to do experiments. So I thought that what we could do was to get around this by actually computerizing what I'd been doing. So around 1984, I started writing programs to do everything that we'd done in a very subjective way. I think this probably will get the approval of Peter. I was helped by the fact that Janet Thornton had come to Birkbeck to join us, Mike Sternberg also, and Lynn Sabanda, in fact, had been working on classification of loops. We've been looking at these families. And I was talking to Roger Needham. I wasn't in Cambridge at the time, but of course he was one of the great computer scientists in Cambridge. And Roger started talking about knowledge-based methods. And so I quite outrageously sent off an article that I wrote. In fact, I did write this with the advice of many of Janet and Lynn. I wrote an article called Knowledge-Based Prediction of Protein Structures and thought that I would be really heavily criticized. My surprise, it was almost immediately published. And I think it first, in a general way, set out the idea that you could use information, bringing it together, to find out about three-dimensional structures, and one could begin to do these predictions in a computerized way, which required information to be available. Not only that, it was going to be relevant to drugs and herbicides and antigen vaccines and so on. And I think that was right. And I think that's probably the first time that in this context, knowledge-based design was used. We published a whole series of reviews after that on this theme. We found that, for example, you could do knowledge-based recognition of sequence families. And this was just a computerization of the old idea that we've been talking about for many years, that if you take the three-dimensional structures and you project them onto a linear sequence, you could get templates. And then if you have a new sequence, you search the database for those templates. That was first written in fact, 1989, 1990. That's one of the early papers on the top. We rehashed it in a program called Fugue, which is now very, very widely used. At the same time, we took Composer, which was written by Mike Sutcliffe, who's now a professor at Manchester. And this was the first program, I think, to do computerized homology modeling or knowledge-based modeling. And that, I have to say, and here I'm getting into the negative scoring with Peter's lecture, I commercialize. But contrary to what Peter was maintaining in his lecture, and I'll be provocative because he can come back, I made it available. I've never commercialized any software that wasn't freely available to any academic. That's been a basic rule. This was for 20 years in the Tripos suite. We then did Modeler. And Modeler has just got up to 4,000 citations, probably the most widely used modeling method. The first one was an assembly of fragments method, and the second one is what we call satisfaction of spatial restraints. And then we move through other different ways of using the information about families, both at the gross level of the fold and in the individual level of the structures. These are all programs. They've almost all been commercialized. Every one of them is free to any academic here. The latest one that's been causing some upset in Protein Data Bank is Wrapper, which shows that you really ought to define protein structures by ensembles. And of course, that would mean probably 100 ensembles, members of the ensemble for each protein structure. You can easily do it. 70,000 structures in the Protein Data Bank. I haven't been able to persuade anyone to take it on as a serious objective. We ought to be able to do it if computational power is not a problem. And I wrote an article on that in Nature Structural Biology to no effect. The other thing, of course, we realized, and as you can see, I'm following Peter all along, was that the information was dreadful. Actually, Protein Data Bank's always available, but it's the most antiquated system. It's getting much better now under PDBE and other initiatives. But for ages, it was just hugely antiquated. And so 5 years ago, what we decided to do was not only to get everything into a relational database system, but also to make it completely open source and publicly available. And I found six very bright students who'd all worked in industry before and then come back to do their PhDs, Sung Sam and Semin in Korea, Adrian and Richard in Informatica, and Alicia in UCB, and we, that's in the bottom there, had I guess a little less experience in industry. But what we tried to do then was to formalize all of these things we've been doing. So we have Takata, which is a database of structurally aligned and annotated structures. We have BEPA, protein nucleic acid, Piccolo, protein protein, Credo, protein ligand, and Timbal is a rather more information-based system going into the literature. But this seemed to be the necessary requirement. And what we've done, of course, is to process the information, which is something that the PDB has not done on the whole. But I think if you're going to use the information, you need to do this. So just one word about one of the programs, Credo by Adrian Schreier. And this does all kinds of things like representing contacts as interaction, fingerprints, does sequence to structure mapping. It uses other people's ideas but incorporates them into the database, like the ultra-fast shape recognition. It takes all ligands and fragments them, so you can search for fragments as well as structures, and it links them in to approved drugs. And that's totally downloadable. It's totally open source. Anybody can use it. And many of the referees, when we've been discussing this in grant applications, are saying, oh, this must be available all over the place. In fact, if you go and search, that information in that form is not easily available. It's in lots of companies, but it's not that easy to get in an open source system. So what we've done is to build a modeling pipeline with the databases on the left, moving through the software on the right, so that we can build any set of structures in a very high throughput way. And I'm not going to describe this, but if you take Mycobacterium tuberculosis, we can build about half the genome, about 47%, pretty accurately. I mean, they're poor experimental models, I guess, but pretty accurately. Another 25% in a way where we can get general ideas about the topology and what sort of class they are, all useful stuff, and about 25% where we can't do anything. And we're, of course, improving the methods. Now, in the genome sequences, here's Jim being proud that he's had his own sequence done. Of course, it was a commercial exercise, I note, and he's talking about the personalized genomic medicine and, of course, the age of the 1,000 genomes. So one of the questions we've been asking is, how can we use all this information to make it available in totally in the public domain to look at these kinds of questions? And what I'm proud of is that I've written lots of fudge programs with the help of my very good team. This is a typical one. There's lots of ways of estimating the effect of a mutation. But if you have 1.5 million non-synonymous single nucleotide polymorphisms, you've got to do it quickly. And this is a method where we have pseudo-energy functions derived from substitution tables, and you can run through literally millions of mutations and get an idea of whether they have an effect. And here's another method which I'm very pleased about, and this is called Crescendo. And what this does is it says, imagine you have a protein structure in isolation, and imagine that I can predict the mutations occurring in evolutionary time, neutral mutations, and now I compare it with the actual mutations that occur, then of course the difference is that I've not accounted for the interactions of that isolated molecule. So if I take the difference, I should be able to see where interactions are, and of course you can. Protein-protein interactions, protein-ligand interactions, you don't have to know what it's interacting with, you can get an idea. So now I can go right through any database, and I can model mutations, and I can estimate areas where these proteins will be interacting, and I can ask the question, will these mutations be affecting either structure or function, given that I equate function with interactions? And so what I can do is to go through the OMIM database, that's the Mendelian database, and predict them using all these different kinds of algorithms. Anybody can do this, totally available. And we can also do analyses of somatic mutations occurring in cancer. This is Sung Sam's analysis. And you can show that cancer somatic mutations are actually very different from Mendelian mutations, but they're slightly different from neutral polymorphisms. And we can begin to go through, and I've got lots of analyses of these, a lot of the case control stuff, so the on one side, and all the developing stuff in the COSMIC database. But you not only have to have the information, but you have to have it available quickly. And I just then want to make a counter comment about the future, because I really do get a bit fed up by everybody telling me that all we need is to organize the information. There's almost nothing you can do, even on a simple yeast, at the moment with mathematical models, because we don't have the data. The next 10 years, we've got to collect good data. You can't even model simple bacteria because we don't know what all the catalytic coefficients are under the right conditions. You know a few, but you don't know enough. And you don't know the pathways. And this is a good example, a little bit more complicated, of the Berthog-Dubé syndrome, which is a syndrome that leads to these very funny benign cancers on follicles. That's why the molecule involved is called folliculin. But then leads to these terrible oncocytic cysts and very, very aggressive tumors. And we've been looking at that. And this is a molecule that's obviously a hub molecule. And we know nothing about it. So don't let anybody tell me from this kind of meeting that we've got enough information. We've got the wrong information. We need to have lots of experimentalists going in there. And I think computational biologists, engineers, and others ought to come and work in biological labs and really find out what the problem is. Because producing all these models of the cell is going to cause a hell of a problem unless we have the right data. I feel very, very strongly about this issue. And this one, we still don't know what it does. We have some ideas that it's a GTPase. We've got experimental structures. We still don't know where we're going. So what about drug discovery? And I'll say a few words about this. I've always felt the kinds of information we've had in the gene to target, obviously genomics, structural genomics, proteomics, metabolomics contribute there. And in a way, what I've been describing so far is describing the exploration of biological space. But of course, we can also explore the chemical space and the interaction between the two. And this is something that I've been addressing and I think is the future. And here I begin to sink because I become commercialized And the reason for that is, of course, it was impossible to get money for this sort of thing out of public coffers in the 1990s. It's becoming much more easy now, and lots of academics are moving out of companies like ours into academia. But we set up Aztec Therapeutics. This is Chris Abel, as Harinjyoti, the road driver, looking as if he's not in chemical space but in a spaceship. We got $500,000 funding, two people in the lab, moved two people, including Harin, above the local shopping center, and then we proved it worked. And in the following years, we've employed between 80 and 100 people. It's varied a little bit. I've stayed as a non-executive member. We built a big building. We lasted in my lab for 12 months, and the ethics committee threw me out. And this is the general idea of the methodology. What we're going to do is, rather experimentally, rather than computationally, I don't know whether it's possible to get the lights down here, we could see better. We're sharing this molecule using biophysical methods with very small fragments, and we're waiting for one of these to hit. And then we use all our knowledge of protein ligand interactions to grow that fragment into a drug-like molecule. And this is a way of exploring chemical space, I believe, much more efficiently than we can with large molecules. You can get away with libraries of 1,000 to 2,000 fragments instead of libraries of a million compounds. You need a good multidisciplinary team, and here's some examples of exploring biological space with fragments. It's the sort of thing that Peter Goodford did first computationally, but we're doing it experimentally, and you can do it very quickly. Here's an example in the company, not my work, but in the company, of FGF receptor. This is a key target in many types of myeloma, bladder cancer, breast tumors. And this is the work of 2 years, molecular design using the fragment screening growth methodology. And this turned out to give us molecules. This is a mouse xenograft where you can see the green one is a chiron molecule out there, and the black one is our molecule. And you can see we've got something that is better than the chiron molecule, and it's also more specific. The chiron molecule actually hits many, many more kinases. So, of course, this all leads to the sort of things you need to advertise. And these are molecules we have in-house, which are into phase two, three into phase two, a little bit out of date now, with many other targets coming along the line. Here you see we've had to get into bed, and very productively so, with a number of companies. We've had four deals of around $30 million a year for developing in collaboration with companies. This really means that we don't know what happens to many of the projects afterwards, and I certainly can't talk about it. But it does mean that we also have a partner pipeline, which is quite impressive coming out of that. So that's, in a way, my talk on the company. But I just want to end up by talking about where we can complement that with totally open source or close to open source drug discovery and where that's going to be useful. And before I do that, I just want to comment that I'm still in mid-career. I have a Wellcome Trust grant, program grant now going up to 2016. I'm very proud to boast about. We're still academic. We have out-licensing or open source. That's the choice of the individual on the program. And as you can see, I've been supping with the venture capitalists. And I just want to make those 2 points. First, no software that we've developed has not been available to academics. And secondly, I've tried to keep away from conflicts of interest by not having large grants from my company in my lab. A number of people in Cambridge do this. I think we shouldn't on the whole. I just wanted to make those points of principle. So what are the challenges? The challenges are really For the future, we have total lack of selectivity because companies have worked on large families of enzymes. We really ought to be going for regulatory mechanisms like allostery or interrupting partners. So in my academic lab, we've looked at signaling pathways like the FGF receptor. These all involve multi-protein systems, which we're now trying to think about how we would interrupt. And also in the lab, we've been looking at another complex system, and it makes you realize that almost everything in the cell is regulated by multi-protein systems, which again, let me emphasize, before you build too many computer models, we don't know much about them. This is double-strand break repair. I know what all the interactions are, but I don't know what the assemblies are at different points of time. And we don't have enough information. What we've done is to define structures of almost all the components. We do things like electron microscopy, nanospray, mass spectrometry, SACs, and so on. And we have a whole lot of information. The problem is most of these involve protein-protein interactions. The left-hand side is Gleevec. You can see Gleevec gets totally covered by the coat of the protein. It's right inside. If we take a protein-protein interaction, there is a fragment sitting in a pocket, and I'm going to briefly talk about this in a moment, and that's all there is. So the challenge of targeting these multi-protein systems is really quite extreme, and that's where we're going. So the first thing, of course, is you need to make sure your database is okay. So this is Piccolo. We can look at protein-protein interactions. We can define core regions and peripheral regions. That's all available, absolutely open access. And then we can collect the drug molecules or the small molecules that interrupt these interfaces. This is TIMBO by Alicia Guerrero. And although she's funded by a company, this is completely freely available. And then what we need to do is to start working, see which systems we can work on. And my approach is to give the fragment library to everyone in my lab and ask them to go and try it on the experimental systems. And this is going to be very quickly. So here's Noah. She just got a PhD this week. She was working on anchoring domains of the Notch receptor. This, according to referees, is an undruggable molecule, but we can get fragments arrayed on it. Here's another one. This is Anna. Noah's from Egypt. Anna's from Iceland. This is hepatocyte growth factor. We're looking at protein-protein interactions. We get lots of ligands bound. So the question is, can we take these further and get them into preclinical and into clinical trials and design drugs? So a few years ago, when the Wellcome Trust had sold their interest in the Wellcome Foundation and became able to fund drug discovery, they asked us what we might do, and I put forward actually six programs first, including the ones on there, and we focused down to two. The Notch one was argued as not being suitable for the wrong reasons, actually, we focused on not non-homologous end joining, but homologous recombination. I'm just going to go through this very, very quickly. This came out of a Nature paper where the work was done by Luca Pellegrini in my lab in collaboration with Ashok Venkataraman. What you can show is that the interaction between BRCA2 and RAMP51 controls the movement of this molecule, this recombinase involved in DNA repair from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. If we overexpress bits of the BRCA2, which is the breast cancer-related gene product, we can show that the FOCI you see on the right-hand side is a fluorescent-labeled method from Ashok's lab. It doesn't work, so we know the peptide works, and we're now going to try and find ligands which do the same thing. And just to show you what the difficulty is, here's part of the BRCA2. This is all experimental data, and here's the RAB51, and we've got to target these two little pockets. It's not a big active site. And that's the interaction that brings it from the cytoplasm into the nucleus. But here, quite fascinatingly, is the protein nucleic filament which is in the nucleus where the Rab51 assembles. And you see there's an exactly equivalent interaction. Both protein interactions, if we can get one or the other by the same mechanism of inhibiting the recombinase, then we've got something. Now I'm going to whip through this. We do in the lab, and I'd like to point out Chris Abel at the top there from this department, co-founder of Aztecs, but also collaborator all along in this open kind of drug discovery, and Marco Hirvonen, who's done most of the driving of this project. So we screen using thermal shift or surface plasma resonance. We do X-ray, mass spec, NMR and so on, ITC. These are fragments bound. This is fragments growing and getting better. That's what my fork, Peter. Wellcome Trust told me I couldn't release the structure. You can see I'm very neurotic about all this. This is the drug discovery program, 2 years. We got into preclinical now, and we got a grant for $2.6 million to take this into the clinic. So for the future, this is where I think we have to go. And then just one other area of academia, and that's in neglected diseases. Just as well, I'm coming to the end, I'm losing my voice. And this is Gates Foundation and EU, collaboration again with Chris Abel, TB, which is particularly important for me because my wife comes from Southern Africa, where you can see the red. What we've been able to do there is to use all these methods on a whole range of TB targets and get into high nanomolar compounds with at least one of the targets. And I think this is an area where we may have to avoid the pharmaceutical industry and move, as the Indians are doing now in their open source drug discovery program, to move into an area where we move with public funding into phase three, collaborate with not drug companies, but companies which are just making molecules to put on the market and then keep it open source. So just to sum up then, having listened to Peter's lecture, though I can see he's going to put me right later, I think we're doing a bit on open source, but you can see on the CML, the mashups and the bioclips, I still have a lot to learn, so I'm looking forward to the rest of the day. All I can say is that I will try not to use PowerPoint in the future, and we'll look forward to having some lessons on that. PDFs I'm happy to abandon. The pharmaceutical industry, I look forward to Peter's comments on how we should interpret that. And the American Chemical Society, well, I guess that just has to change. And I just want to make the point at the end that this is all a multidisciplinary team. We have and have had for the last 40 years computer scientists, engineers, medics, chemists, biologists, all in the lab. This multidisciplinary thing is not a recent one, but it's obviously absolutely essential if we're going to move to have a future, indeed a semantic molecular future. So I leave you with that. Thank you very much and look forward to hearing what everyone has to say about the semantic web in the following part of the day. And congratulate Peter for all his influence on me and many of my colleagues. Thank you very much.
Against commercialization, I'm against monopolistic control of information, and I'm also concerned about the asymmetry between the generation of information and knowledge from academia and the return we ought to get back from industry. I think there should be a symmetric balance. That's what I was concerned with in that lecture, that what was happening is that all the innovation in academia was going into pharma. I'm talking about software and informatics, not about compounds and so on, and they were not helping to grow that in academia.
Well, of course, what's happening now is that academia is getting quite a lot of feedback because the model from the pharmaceutical industry is becoming an open innovation one to a much greater extent. The model they have is not sustainable, I think most people agree, and so outsourcing is important. But one of the interesting things, if you look at, I see some members of Aztecs around in the audience, if you look, we've lost a whole lot of colleagues from Aztecs now who are now running academic labs in Dundee and Institute of Cancer Research and elsewhere. So, of course, one of the ways that industry is helping academia in this rather more challenging time in drug discovery is by exporting people. It's something we academics always boast about, exporting people to industry, but it's actually happening in the opposite direction as well.
Thank you very much, Tom. Tom?